Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, January 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, new major developments in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump.
The bottom line is very simple. We want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's what witnesses and documents mean.
Foreigners are being evacuated from China as the deadly coronavirus continues to spread. Also ahead, a growing number of young people in South Africa are dramatically changing the way they eat. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump's legal team on Tuesday concluded its three-day presentation as they started it, arguing that the Democrats' case amounted to partisan politics that would undo the results of the 2016 presidential election and drive Trump from office. Trump's lawyers argued forcefully against calling former National Security Advisor John Bolton as a witness, saying his yet-to-be-published manuscript contains unproven allegations that would be inadmissible during a typical trial. As the defense used less than half of its allotted 24 hours of argument, White House counsel Pat Cipollone said the impeachment trial should end now and as quickly as possible. Democrats, meanwhile, and some moderate Republicans did press to call Bolton and other witnesses as the case headed to the phase of questions and answers. And as a new Quinnipiac poll has found that 75% of Americans believe the trial should include witnesses, the Senate Majority Leader now apparently telling his colleagues he does not have the votes to block witnesses. Joining us now to understand all of what has been happening in these fast-moving, developing stories in the impeachment trial of President Trump is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. He's joining us live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Jack, always great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you again.
Things changing rapidly. The president and Republicans have been hoping this thing would go quickly, very quickly, and end with the president's acquittal. That's what the goal was initially. It doesn't look like it's going quite as planned, is it?
Well, yeah, that's clearly the case. Obviously, what Mitch McConnell was trying to accomplish really this week was to have the Democrats from the House investigative team essentially come in, make their arguments very quickly, and in fact, they organized how long both sides could argue. And then the president's team would come in, and for the last 3 days, his team has come in to argue in defense of the president with the idea that there would be no witnesses called and that ultimately the Senate would vote to acquit. And this would be over by the end of the week. And I think that was the plan. But what really threw a wrench into the works in this case was Ambassador Bolton. Again, there's this talk of him having a book that's coming out. And in the end, what this book is apparently going to say is that the president told John Bolton that, in fact, the quid pro quo does exist. This did happen. Plus, actually, some other things about some other witnesses who are aware of this. Now, the problem with that issue is that despite what Dershowitz is arguing, that's one of the president's team, that this would be inadmissible, that's not the case. This is something called a statement against interest. If the president says, I committed a crime to somebody, guess what? If that person takes the stand and says, that's what the president told me, generally speaking, that's going to come in. So this is going to be interesting. We're going to see exactly how far the Republicans are willing to go to simply turn their backs and say, you know what? It doesn't matter.
Well, I just recently heard some analysis just before we came on the air that Mitch McConnell doesn't let things like this leak about not having the votes unless he's got a plan and reason why he's letting that leak. And that that analysis anyway was that he's looking for help from some of Trump's allies like Fox News and the president himself to try to convince Republicans not to vote, to vote to block witnesses from happening. At this point, with what's happening and the news that they cannot put back in the box, how likely is that?
Well, the interesting twist that's coming now is this, and you're starting to see a pivot from the president's team. And what they're starting to argue in the end is that it doesn't matter what John Bolton says. And in fact, what they're saying, and several have already come out now starting to hem and haw about this, arguing that, you know what, even if there was a quid pro quo, even if the president actually for his own personal benefit actually withheld this $391 million from Ukraine, and he did it even to help his own presidential campaign for 2020, he's allowed to do it. So even if John Bolton could come forward and say that, it doesn't matter because, again, presidents do this all the time. The problem with that is that presidents don't do this all the time. This is something that is not supposed to happen. But it comes back to this one question. What we know now is that the Republicans seem, and they have said this very publicly, they are hell-bent in ensuring that the president is acquitted in this case. And I think regardless of the evidence that shows up, that's where they're going to go. The real problem is that in some of those recent polls, as you mentioned, some 75% of Americans want to know what happened. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I think it's important that they know that, not just for this case, but for all cases and for what the presidency stands for.
And if they continue to ignore the facts that potentially implicate the president, what happens next?
Well, if they decide to ignore the facts, the president's going to be acquitted. He is. But you know what? The blowback that has the potential of showing up here is that there will be not just Democrats. Let's face it, generally speaking, the Democrats are already looking at this from a certain perspective. There are the moderates. There are those in the middle, and there may be some of those on the Republican side who will simply say, you know what? That's not who we are. So the concern that the president does have in this case is not even about the question of the acquittal. That seems to be in the bag. The real question is going to be what happens in November, because everybody's watching that.
So, in other words, this may be really a decision that will ultimately be in the hands of voters.
Well, sadly, I think in the end, I think that is the case. But this wasn't about the question of voting. This was about the behavior of one president and whether or not that was something that is beyond the pale by the American people. And that's a broader question. And I'm really disturbed about what this has the potential of meaning down the road for not just this guy, not just this president, but the next one and the one after that.
As far as getting help to go after rivals and potentially, you know, paint a light on them that would be beneficial to him or president.
It encourages his behavior and it encourages any future president's behavior. But as importantly, what we've also seen is the ability of this president to literally say, I've decided unilaterally that I am not going to cooperate, and I'm going to stop anybody and everybody who is a legitimate witness from actually cooperating and following the law and actually testifying as they are obligated to do. This unilaterally stops the ability and the power of Congress to actually oversee the presidency. And if we accept that, we have just fundamentally changed the Constitution.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Well, we always appreciate your perspective. That is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. He's coming to us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you so much for your perspective. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, the latest polls show Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders surging in the Democratic primary race, both in national surveys and in Iowa, where the first contest of the 2020 campaign kicks off on Monday. Sanders is among several top Democratic contenders that support in the Iowa presidential caucuses, and the outcome is seen as crucial in what could be a long battle for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
So let's bring in Senator Bernie Sanders.
In Iowa, Bernie Sanders is counting on late momentum to carry him to victory in the Iowa caucuses.
So what we are saying unabashedly, unapologetically, is yes, our administration will be an administration of the working class of this country. That's where I come from. That's who I am.
Sanders is hoping to score a top finish in Iowa at the expense of national frontrunner Joe Biden.
I'm still standing and I'm getting stronger.
Biden has long argued that he would be the strongest Democrat to take on President Donald Trump in November and unite the country.
The next president is going to inherit a country that's divided and a world in disarray. And I'll respectfully suggest there's going to be no time for on-the-job training. It's going to have to be immediately know what he or she is going to do.
We're going to do this.
Another strong contender in Iowa is Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who promises to bring sweeping change if elected.
If there is a decision to be made in Washington, I guarantee it has been influenced by money. And if we are going to fix that, you can't just nibble around the edges. You can't do just a little tweak here or a little twist there. It's going to take big structural change.
I'm going to be brief in my remarks.
Rounding out the top tier is former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, a relative newcomer to the national political stage.
I believe the purpose of the presidency is not to glorify the president. It is to empower and unify the American people to get big things done. That's why I'm asking for your support, and that's what tonight is about for us.
The majority leader is
the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump has forced four of the Democratic contenders to attend the proceedings. That has taken Sanders, Warren, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar off the campaign trail in Iowa at a crucial time.
We're going to sit there till the very end. We're going to listen to the evidence. And as I noted, I can do two things at once. I'm a mom, and I will find one way or another to run for president.
Even with the late Sanders surge, the polls suggest a close, unpredictable race in Iowa, says analyst John Fortier.
Democratic voters are really just starting to focus on this, and that's why I do think there is some room for change. The voters on the ground in Iowa and the voters nationally have some sense of these candidates, but are really going to start focusing their minds. I think the biggest thing on Democrats' minds is they want to beat Donald Trump.
The Iowa caucuses are the first stage of a lengthy primary process that will produce a Democratic presidential nominee at the party's nominating convention in July in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. 50 U.S. service members have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries following that Iranian missile strike. A magnitude 7.7 earthquake hits between Cuba and Jamaica. And a Kenyan football team has emerged from slums to rise to the top. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, countries on Wednesday began evacuating their citizens from the Chinese city hardest hit by an outbreak of a deadly and highly contagious new virus. China's latest figures indicate close to 6,000 cases on the mainland, and that was a rise of the 1,400-plus from the previous day. Dozens of infections of the new type of coronavirus have been confirmed also outside mainland China. Earlier in the morning, a plane carrying Americans who'd been in Wuhan left for Anchorage, Alaska, where they will be rescreened for the virus. Hospitals are preparing to treat or quarantine people who may be infected. Meanwhile, Chinese authorities have announced a temporary ban on selling wildlife in response to the virus that spread from a game market in the city of Wuhan. This isn't the first time these markets have bred a new disease, and experts say it likely won't be the last. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Wild animals are spared from dinner tables for now, as Chinese authorities crack down on game markets. Officials are temporarily closing markets that sell wildlife for food. The same thing happened in 2002 after civet cats at a live animal market in southern China infected people with SARS. That outbreak ultimately killed 800 people.
So it's very disconcerting that we can't seem to learn this lesson about where this risk is coming from.
Veterinarian William Karish is vice president of EcoHealth Alliance. He says live animal markets pack lots of stressed out animals together in a small space. It's a perfect environment for spreading disease.
Now, most animals, of course, are not infected and are not shedding viruses, but it only takes one or two. And as they come to a market where it's crowded, there's other live animals there, they can start spreading it around. It's like kids going to kindergarten. One of them shows up sick, and next thing you know, everybody else is taking it home to their parents.
Harris says game markets especially can breed new diseases because they bring together animals and their germs that would normally never mix. It's a golden opportunity for a germ to find a new species to infect. Thousands of animals pass through these markets every day, and there are thousands of these markets around the world with millions of shoppers. With numbers like that, Karish says,
the chances of one virus making it through, winning the lottery, and getting into people is pretty high.
People don't always shop at live markets by choice, Karish says. When there's no refrigeration, it's the best way to know your meat is fresh.
So it's almost safer to see an animal that's live. It's alive, it's healthy, you know. No one found it dead on the road and now is trying to sell it to you as good meat. So there's rational reasons why that exists. But that world is also changing.
Around the world, supermarkets are replacing live markets. Their offerings may be less exotic, but Karish adds, they're safer for everyone. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Afghan officials in eastern Ghazi province tell VOA American forces have recovered the bodies of two U.S. pilots whose plane crashed in the region Monday. It's something U.S. defense officials have also confirmed. VOA's Asif Husani in Ghazni spoke with the province's police chief and local officials and files this report, which is narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
The American Bombardier E-11A went down in eastern Ghazni Monday afternoon local time. Since then, Afghan security forces have tried but failed to reach the crash site, the province's governor tells VOA.
Because that area is pretty remote and it is an insecure area, our security forces and officials have yet to get to the site. But we are working on it so that we can shine some light on what kind of casualties are there.
U.S. troops reached the aircraft Tuesday and recovered two bodies as well as the flight recorder. The U.S. military said they faced no Taliban resistance. Taliban and Iranian media claimed the plane was shot down without providing evidence. U.S. and Afghan authorities say they are still investigating what caused the crash, but say there is no evidence it was downed by enemy fire. The Civil Aviation Authority of Afghanistan said it tracked the flight before it went down, but did not share news of the crash in real time with the public or media.
After confirming all aircraft that exit or enter Afghanistan airspace, we informed that this wasn't a civilian airplane, and any information about a military plane in that situation and in that time, there was never a need to share that.
The U.S. military said the plane was in the area to act as a communication hub for troops on the ground. For Asif Husseini in Ghazni and Jalal Mirzad in Kabul, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Well, U.S. President Donald Trump Tuesday unveiled his plan to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's a plan which strongly favors Israel. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was visiting the White House and stood alongside Trump as the U.S. president made the announcement. Palestinian leaders say they were not invited. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said, quote, 1,000 no's to the plan. At a news conference in the West Bank city of Ramallah, where the Western-backed Palestinian Authority is headquartered, Abbas said the Palestinians remain committed to ending the Israeli occupation and establishing a state with its capital in East Jerusalem. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wuttakuswara has this report from the White House.
Palestinians in Gaza burned pictures of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu as the two leaders met in the White House, where Trump announced his vision to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The plan recognizes Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem and redraws the borders of the West Bank.
We will form a joint committee with Israel to convert the conceptual map into a more detailed and calibrated rendering so that recognition can be immediately achieved.
The plan did not abandon the two-state solution, calling for a future state of Palestine with a capital in East Jerusalem. Trump said it will double Palestinian territory in exchange for Israeli sovereignty over settlement blocks in the West Bank and a four-year freeze of Israeli settlement construction.
Not accepting it would mean the continued, perhaps the continued loss of territory to settlements. It does not seem as though the Palestinians have a constructive way out. They no longer enjoy the intense or financial support of many of the Arab powers. So in a way, yes, it may seem like a take it or leave it, but it may be the best deal that they are going to get.
Prior to the plan, Trump recognized Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights and moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The Palestinians were not involved in the plan and swiftly rejected it.
It fundamentally makes it impossible for Palestinians to have self-determination, and it completely casts aside international law and human rights. It validates the settlements, and it validates a circumstance which has been condemned by every major human rights body, and it is no context for peace.
The plan could lead the way for an Israeli annexation of the Jordan Valley portion of the West Bank, a Netanyahu campaign promise.
Too many plans tried to pressure Israel to withdraw from vital territory like the Jordan Valley. But you, Mr. President, you recognize that Israel must have sovereignty in the Jordan Valley and other strategic areas of Judea and Samaria.
Both Trump and Netanyahu are up for re-election, and critics question the timing of the plan.
It's a ploy to appeal to the right-wing Israeli settler movement as well as evangelicals in the United States, and it's certainly not anything like a peace plan.
Netanyahu is facing charges of corruption at home, while the U.S. Senate is conducting an impeachment trial whether to remove Trump from office.
He still is, I think, attempting to show that his administration has the foreign policy gravitas to try and push for a Middle East settlement. And this is, in effect, an argument for not convicting him and not replacing him as president now, since he's carrying out the foreign policy of the United States.
Since the 1993 Oslo Peace Accord, American presidents have tried and failed to broker a peace deal in the Middle East. Last June, Trump released the economic portion of the plan, which Palestinians also rejected. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Well, veganism is spreading among South Africa's young, socially aware residents who note that their quest to eliminate animal products from their diets has provoked interesting arguments about the role of meat in African culture and spirituality. VOA's Anita Powell looks at the new wave of Afri-vegans and brings this report from Johannesburg.
Plant-based foods are getting a bigger place at the table in meat-loving South Africa as more and more people experiment with vegetarian and vegan lifestyles. Veganism, which entails cutting out all meat and animal-derived products, is slowly growing globally. A Google Trends report puts South Africa as ranking 14th globally in searches for vegan, the only African nation to rank so high. While there is no official count of how many vegans are in South Africa, the interest has led to a sprouting of vegetarian and vegan restaurants in Johannesburg, the nation's economic hub. And this year, Africa's first large-scale vegan and plant-based exposition will land in Cape Town. Many new vegans cited moral and health reasons, like financial advisor Dialan Nayagar, who made the switch last year.
And I got introduced to this whole new way of eating, healthy eating, organic type food from plants, and I couldn't believe it. Like I said, blew my mind, and I got fully involved into it and haven't turned back.
But say the owners of one of Johannesburg's hippest, newest vegan eateries, vegans don't have to explain themselves to anyone.
All I'm trying to do is live a life that's sustainable for me, and that makes me happy.
Her business partner, Anesu Mvizo, who is also a medical doctor, says that most people cite health reasons for the switch.
Meat is full of saturated fat, and saturated fat is a huge cardiovascular risk. It leads to heart attacks, strokes. It's been implicated in diabetes as well, and your veggies and your fruit don't have that, so or have very low levels of that. So I think in terms of that, if you're eating the correct portion, and you're eating the right thing, then totally a vegan lifestyle can definitely be healthier than a meat-based diet.
But veganism can be a lonely road. Many South Africans we approached expressed horror at the thought of giving up meat, which is central to celebrations and spirituality. That's a challenge for many African vegans, including Vijo. Her father runs a cattle farm, and they've debated the high cost of giving up his business, which supports a community in Zimbabwe.
In African culture, a big part of a family's net worth is their livestock. Their livestock define the wealth of a family. And so when you slaughter an animal at a gathering, it's seen as you giving of yourself. Whereas getting some vegetables from your veggie patch doesn't really equate to the same amount of giving. So I think that that's still something that I think the African continent as a whole will need to grapple with when it comes. And I think that's one of the barriers to veganism for people of African cultures.
But some are finding a middle path. 31-year-old Tandiwe Ngubeni, a communications specialist, still eats meat, but less and less of it as time goes by.
I feel way more energized when I eat a vegetarian or vegan meal. It actually just gives me more energy.
Seki, who has been vegan since 2017, endorses the slow and steady approach.
There's no right way of doing anything. I think, yes, there are many benefits of being vegan, especially for the animals in terms of them being killed and all of that. But this is a choice that only you can make.
Instead, she says, just take it one bite at a time. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you're listening to International Edition. We will be back in a minute.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Well, as the world comes to grips with the loss of basketball great Kobe Bryant, who was killed Sunday in a helicopter crash, fans in Los Angeles have been paying tribute to the sports legend who called the city his home. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan tells us many say that Bryant was their inspiration.
An outpouring of grief outside Staples Center, home of the L.A. Lakers, where Kobe Bryant spent most of his career. He died in a helicopter crash with his 13-year-old daughter and 7 others. Thousands have come to mourn at this growing memorial.
Kobe was my son's basketball idol, and I allowed him, as a little boy growing up, to watch Kobe play and brought him to the Staples Center. So I'm here to kind of bring closure to a family and to let his family know that we care about them and love them and we'll always have them close to us in our heart.
Kobe came from Philadelphia but made L.A. his own.
He brought a lot of people together. He did a lot for the community. And he's not even from L.A., but, you know, he's from Philly, but he still did a lot for the community, you know. You know, he gave it back.
Touching many lives.
He's, you know, like a celebrity. You've never met him, but, like, when I was younger, I broke my leg, and I would just sit at home while everyone else was out playing, and I would just watch him play, and he was just like somebody to help you keep going. And it's just like, like part of your life.
Students at Marymount California University also grew up with Kobe Bryant.
When you're 5, 6, 7 years old, he's bringing championships to L.A. They're having the parades. You see everything's Kobe, and it's like you grow up idolizing him.
His intensity was inspiring.
He kind of taught a lot of people how to live life and just go for everything that you possibly could think of. Get what you want and get what you deserve.
He overcame obstacles. A quotation from Kobe Bryant on recovering from an injury inspired another fan.
I have the quote here on my phone, actually, and I sometimes look at it to kind of like find strength.
Coping with the shock of lives cut short in a tragic accident, a sports icon among the victims. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today. We thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. And thank you, of course, for listening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.